Did you miss us when we were away?
Hello.
We're back from our holidays with a new edition of Big Mouth, the pop culture talk show for the thinking train spotter. My name is Andrew Harrison, and on the agenda this week, new albums from Paul Weller and druidical scouser Jane Weaver. Can Weller sustain his late-blooming new weird incarnation? Can we finally stop calling him the Modfather? And who exactly is Jane Weaver? And why is her Mersey motoric scouse kraut worthy of your attention? Also, we'll be looking at I Was There When House Took Over the World, which pretty much does what it says on the tin. This is a new on-demand documentary two-parter from Channel 4 covering the early days of Rave. Can you tell the story of House in two 20-minute episodes directed by Sting's son? We will find out. And finally, we'll be taking a look at Alien Covenant, the sixth part of the Alien trilogy. How does that work? Mathematically, I don't know. Director Ridley Scott is back in the world of chestbursters and tongues with teeth on the end of them. The second prequel, featuring Michael Fassbender as Walter the Robot, promises to explain exactly where the aliens come from. Is Scott breathing new life into the alien story or just flogging a dead facehugger? And of course, we'll be playing some of our guests' favourite tunes of the minute. So, let's meet them. They're both Big Mouth first-timers. Rebecca Nicholson writes for The Guardian and The Sunday Times. Among her recent victims are Jane Birkin, Isabel Huppert, Julian Barrett of Mighty Boosh, in connection with his movie Mindhorn, and Bananarama, who looks like a proper pop handful. Hello, Rebecca. Welcome to Big Mouth. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. I've really been ticking them off, haven't I?
You certainly have. So, Bananarama... Were they a proper pop handful?
Oh, they were a proper pop handful. Mm. It was such a treat to talk to them because I had been a massive Shakespeare sister fan.
You don't hear that very often.
No, I know. I think there's me and Priya Alan, who's now the editor of The Guide, is also a massive Shakespeare sister fan. So after the interview, we were texting each other going, what was she like? So, it was brilliant. They seemed to really enjoy a good time. And they were very, very frank about everything, which was brilliant. I kind of didn't expect them to be quite as honest as they were.
They are, I mean, you tend to forget because they started quite young and quite early. They just represent a totally different era when you could actually be properly famous in the charts, in the top five, and still be on the Dole.
Yeah.
And not get recognised by the bloke in the Dole.
Well, they did say they had to go to the Dole in disguise because they were on Top of the Pops, but they were completely broke and they were being flown to these fancy hotels all around the world and then going back and signing on because they had no money.
But to be fair, most people signing on look like they were in Bananarama anyway. the ratty jumpers and the ratty... And the hair that Terry Hall copied for the Fun Way 3. The yucca plant hair.
They were also, they've just been recently cropping up on the Top of the Pops reruns.
Yes.
Right at their very start of their career. And it's brilliant. See, you just like watch it. And we just sit there watching it every week going, who in a record company thought, let's just let them on stage because they don't even know the words, really. Or if they do, they're not really bothered about actually kind of miming them properly. And Sarah's kind of shuffling around having a fag at the back of the stage.
And styling hadn't been invented yet. I mean, really speaking, like Little Mix ought to be the heirs to Bananarama, rather. They ought to be just like falling on stage in whatever crap they happen to have on. But they've been styled and they've been turned into a pop group.
It's too glossy. I can't imagine anything like that happening again because it's all so thought out now and so considered and so polished and they just don't seem to have been that way in any way at all.
Did they really plough through the wine? Because I did them once. They demolished the wine like a truck.
I was really disappointed that they didn't, but it was a Thursday afternoon.
And
I mean, that's coming up to the weekend. It is practically. But Siobhan was very, very dozy because she'd just about an hour before got off a plane from LA. But no wine, sadly.
Well, I'm disappointed in the non-answer. Also with us, and also making his Big Mouth debut, is Stevie Chick, who writes about actual plank spanking hard rock and metal in Kerrang, Mojo and The Guardian. He is the author of Spray Paint the Walls, The Black Flag Story, and also Ninja Tune, 20 Years of Beats and Pieces, which pretty much covers the spread as far as I'm concerned. And he also co-edits the music photography magazine Loose Lips Sink Ships. Welcome to Big Mouth, Stevie.
Oh, it's good to be here. Yeah, I'm really good, thanks. Really good.
Jolly good. Who have you been talking to in the grand world of pop lately?
I've been speaking to the members of At The Drive-In a lot recently because they've reformed and... that's been really exciting. Some great stories. I sat down to do a Mojo feature for them just over a month ago, and it ended up being a four-hour conversation.
Yeah.
Which, whenever I mentioned it on Facebook, all the other journalists I knew were just like, oh, that sounds awful and terrible.
It just makes you think 4 hours of transcription, actually means 12 hours of transcription.
My hand was cramping as we had the conversation, but it was a really thrilling interview. I really enjoyed that. So that was... that was the most recent thing.
So, what was the best bit you couldn't put in?
To be honest, it wasn't anything I couldn't put in for legal reasons or for offense. They're very open. Yeah. They share everything, all the drug stories, all of the falling out, all of the upset. But there was a really lovely story because they're all Latino Hispanic guys from the real border of Texas and Mexico. And they were talking about how when they did their very first European tour, they almost couldn't go because their drummer didn't have a passport. Mm. And they had to get him a passport and a visa and stuff. And like his mum had to like hit up their local MP or whatever to get him at the front of the queue. And it was just, it was kind of a poignant thing because we were doing the interview just at the time that the all of the issues with the wall and everything are coming up. And it's very, you know, it is very poignant. It was one of those moments where you realise, oh, well, thank God we're not living in those terrible, oh.
Actually, we are.
Times are even worse now than they were back then. So I don't know.
Oh, God.
Past is prelude, I guess.
But, lovely, yeah. Also, you just heard him then, completing the team for today as ever, is our painstaking producer, the one who ensures that Big Mouth is delivered in 100% lossless high-end hi-fi. It's the Ivor Tiefenbrunner podcast, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Okay, let's get started. As I mentioned earlier, this week we'll be looking at Paul Weller's 13th solo album, A Kind Revolution. Weller famously went weird in the mid-noughties and has been all the more interesting for it. But first, we thought we'd stand up for the lesser-known acts and kick off with Jane Weaver instead. Born in Liverpool and resident in Widnes, she's a former folktronica and electro artist who put out records on Rob's Records, the label run by New Order's manager Rob Gretton in the 90s. But she started to find her own voice in the early 2000s, getting progressively more psychedelic and incantatory and Wiccan. Her career's been a slow burner and only really caught fire with the Silver Globe album in 2014. Modern Cosmology, with a K, is her sixth album proper and it's out at the end of this week. From the album, this is Slow Motion. Kraftwerk on the M62 there. That was Jane Weaver with Slow Motion from the album Modern Cosmology. Now, Rebecca Nicholson, what did you make? What do you make of this record? Are you a crowd type of person?
No. But I had never heard of Jane Weaver until this and sort of went away and Googled and had a look. And I realised that I had heard of Misty Dixon, who she had performed sort of as or with in the 90s. I've got this album that was a Prince covers album by people like Misty Dixon, and Peaches and Feist under a different name had also done a cover. It's a brilliant album. Oh, it's right. Really, I think Hefner might have done a Prince. It's very kind of 90s indie lo-fi, but it's a brilliant album.
Is there an Echo Belly track on it?
Possibly. I'd heard of Misty Dixon through that. I enjoyed this much more than I thought I would. I always slightly bristle at press releases or kind of anything that could come across as slightly pretentious, and there is a slight air of pretentiousness to the press release. There are many adjectives and adverbs involved in that, but it's very enjoyable. It's such a horrible way of describing it. It's lovely.
I think they've probably run into the difficult problem of how many ways can you describe this sounds like krautrock?
Yeah.
because I'm not familiar with anything in her past, and you know, although I have the folkiness of Silver Globe, the previous one, has kind of really been dialed down here, and this is all streaming vistas.
The only time, the first time that I came across was Sean Rowley picked Silver Globe as one of his albums of the year last year, and I started listening to it quite a lot and really got into it because she's very different from anything else that's out at the moment, and I can't really see much of a folk thing in that particular part of her past. She does do things a bit more folky previously, but you know, it's still very
well. It's more
turn up the clang.
Yeah, but it is more sort of witchy, cosmic. Extra caffeine, gold trap, folky. It's folk horror rather than picky guitars and crumb horns.
She's got a really interesting English, one of those pure kind of folk voices. She doesn't particularly use it in a folk way, but it's very kind of crystalline.
Make a note of that, Rebecca.
But you know, it's very kind of clear, and there's no kind of wavering or anything in it. And then what she does with it and the music that she layers it over, I think, is a really interesting juxtaposition.
Yeah, I mean, the feel to me, it's a kind of fantastic 1974 Children of the Stones or Tomorrow People look. You know, there's lots of golden robes and loads of green eyeshadow. Stevie, how psychedelic are you on a scale of 1 to 4?
I'm not even on the scale numerically. Right. I am a tie-dye T-shirt tied to the front of a VW camper van,
exactly,
blazing down the street playing a Grateful Dead bootleg. That's
absolutely
pretty psychedelic.
In Tottenham.
So in Tottenham, there's a few of us out there. But to me, it's funny. It is krauty. It's got these roots and stuff. But I think what we're all missing here is it's it's a series of great 4-minute pop songs.
Yeah.
Like it's, she does have all of this really interesting, bristly, wiry, I don't want to say funky, because but it's got this rhythmic, interesting thing. There's some really sort of interesting undulating synth lines and stuff like that. But she never loses sense of the song. And for me, the exciting thing about her is she is someone who's, you know, she's had several careers. She was in Kill Laura in the late 90s, mm-hmm. sort of post-Britpop thing that never quite happened. Misty Dixon, as we mentioned, which, you know, ended rather tragically as their guitarist Dave Tyack passed away. And for me, what I think is really thrilling about her career is this is an artist. She's like got an auteurist vision. She sits down and she's like, this is what I'm going to do. And what you hear is every piece of it fits in together. Like there's a few tracks where she's doing this amazing thing with just a slight amount of echo on the double track vocals. And it just takes you out there. And for me, this is the thing. She hears every single part of it. She's a complete artist. She's a Bowie-esque type character because she's like, this is who I am on this record. And I'm fusing it all together. I'm really impressed by the totality, the holistic nature of this record.
Holistic.
How's that?
Crystalline.
I'm adding it to my list.
Absolutely. Yeah, put that on the list. Definitely. I mean, what I like about it is that you know, people tend to sort of think of prog as this as this difficult music, this kind of very very male and blokey stuff that's hard to get into. But the best of it is pop, and it's joyful, and it's kind of zooming along the autobahn on a beautiful clear day. Yeah. And I think she's really sort of brought that into her own world. It's taken her a while, hasn't it, to find that voice. This is sixth album or something, but you can really tell that this is the product of a lot of development and a lot of discovering who you are.
There's two different artists, I think, in the world. There's the artist who does everything that they meant to do on the first record, and after that it's really diminishing returns, or like the Ramones, she just managed to keep the same thing going all the way through. She's someone who's going to develop with every record. I really love people who are like that. Like, you know, for me, she's going to, the next record, we talk about how she's found her sound here. The next one's going to be completely different, and the next one's going to be completely different, and that's quite exciting.
And is it a case to be said as well that a case for kind of like being, some would say, stuck in witness and actually able to decide what she wants to be rather than being kind of thrown in the deep end at London and said after one album, right, you're not doing what we want.
Yeah, and I don't know how old she is, but you know, if she's been making music since the mid-90s, I can imagine she's past the point of giving a shit what people think. And that's exciting too. I think that usually can produce really, really exciting results.
Yeah. That, for me, there's a lot of the cosmic northwest in this as well. It's quite sort of you know, the Wicker Man on the East Lancs Road, because it's very flat round there. You know, it's just you in confrontation with nature. Absolutely, yeah, too right. You know, it's and I just, you know, I mean, anybody who's going to put together songs with titles like Loops on the Secret Society, you know, this is kind of it's not immediate. As you say, they are pop songs, but it's very difficult to immediately work out what she's on about. But I like that. There's a lot going on beneath the surface. Like, it kind of alludes to the cosmic unconsciousness rather than being narrative about it. I mean, I mentioned before that like Kraut and sort of and the prog and the kind of King Crimson-y stuff that she draws on, it's notoriously blokey, isn't it? It's very...
But I think that's overstated. I think to
name,
me...
name a woman in Krautrock.
Stacia from Hawkwinds.
The blokiness of it is definitely prevalent. I mean, but it's hard to name women in say heavy rock. I mean, it was a very masculine era. I mean, that's a fair point. Literally on the way here, I was listening to the second Soft Machine album, which is just berserk, weird, gloopy stuff.
And yet you turned up on time. Well, amazing about how is that?
But on you know, within that gloop, there are loads of really interesting ideas, and I think artists like Jane Weaver are listening to this stuff because it's not been raked over. Not all of the influences have been decoded and rethread and. You know, translated, and I think that's the thing. She's able to take those bits and then work them into, instead of being like an album long piece of music that goes off in a million different ways, she's like, there's this weird undulating synth idea, I'm going to whack that down for 4 minutes, and you know, I think that it's a strangely danceable record. For me, it was really punchy and to the point, but that might just explain what I'm listening to when I'm not listening to Jane Weaver. To me, it was a really accessible, enjoyable record.
Well, I got turned on to a bike friend of the podcast, Anthony Teasdale, with the Silver Globe album, because he said, this is really Balearic, this is dead Balearic. It's right up your street. So, yeah, we like it then. Modern Cosmology, we like it. We're giving it high Big Mouth marks. Okay, let's move over to Weller and his new 13th album, A Kind Revolution. Is he staying weird? Let's have a listen. This is one of the lead singles. This is called Nova. We'll be right back. That was David Bowie with Blackstar. I'm sorry. No, that was Paul Weller with Nova from A Kind Revolution. And maybe I'm overstating the weird Weller aspect. It's not exactly Julian Cope meets Scott Walker. But there's quite a lot of Bowie on this record, isn't there? I mean, on that track and on One Tear, he does that very severe operatic low and lodger voice, which you would definitely not associate with Paul Weller, full Night Flights to Venus yodeling. Stevie Chick, what did you make of this album?
Oh, the thing is I really love Weller because I grew up on a South London council estate in the late 70s and...
A mod?
No. I was about two. Mini I could mod. Barely brush my hair, but the Specials, Madness, and the Jam. Like when I hear Going Underground, I'm not thinking about the social political meanings of the lyrics. I'm remembering jumping into a big pile of leaves in the Wandle Park in Colliers Wood. Like it has a Proustian rush for me. And the Style Council are one of the most underrated great bands ever. And then he did this solo stuff, and for me, like the 90s, Weller is just this constant fear that someone's going to get up into your ear and go, "Wild, wild wood," like that, just for ages. I found the solo music such of a turnoff. And then I heard people saying that his recent albums, he's like embraced people that I'm really excited about, like Alice Coltrane and far out ideas like this. And I kind of wanted to listen, but I was kind of scared, so I didn't. And then I listened to this record thinking maybe it's going to be really exciting, maybe it's going to be great. And the first track is called Woozy Mama, and it's spelt very much like Kulu Say Mama, which is the title of a really out there John Coltrane track. And so I was just like, strap myself in, this is going to be pretty crazy. And the ambiance of the track can only be described as like walking into a Midwest bar in America. There's neon signs on the wall. They're serving pissy... Bud Light. The drummer has got a check shirt that's buttoned down and short sleeved, and the whole time you're asking yourself, am I in a commercial for shaving foam? Because the first track is so hoary and hackneyed and rote and terrible, and it's such a shame. And he's singing with this like mid-Atlantic voice, and for me that's where Weller lost it, was when he stopped sounding like an English bloke singing on weird funk with the Style Council, or an English bloke singing about being down at the tube stations at midnight, and then started putting on this fake mid-Atlantic accent. And for me, like the first track was such a turnoff that I went through it, and whenever it did get weird or exciting, and you mentioned, what was it, One Tear, and there's the track that Boy George is on, which had a nice Style Council vibe to it, I very much enjoyed those, but I was very much... again, in fear that the wild, wild wood would come back again.
I remember John Savage was writing about him in the early 2000s, and John Savage, not a fan of Paul Weller, saying how he did never separate Heavy Soul from Neil's Heavy Concept album, the Young Ones spin-off album. And I suppose that, to me, that phase of Weller was very kind of like, super serious. It's kind of mid-90s, mid-noughties rather, with Sonic Kicks and so on, he started to get more experimental and stranger. Rebecca, what did you make of it?
Yeah, well, I feel like this is a slightly shameful confession for a semi-retired music journalist, but the first time I came across Paul Weller was pretty much Wild Wood era, and it was always the track that I skipped on like the free CDs you get with Q, and I kind of
they'll probably put them together,
get to Blur. So I guess that's what I expected listening to this. And then I'd read all the stuff about him going weird, and like Stevie, I think I expected it to be much
further out.
Yeah.
I was pretty surprised that because, you've got a couple of tracks like this track Hopper has this strange sort of rainy day woman sort of strolling horn section. And One Tear actually starts with the kind of harps and the cosmic expansion and the kind of Lewis Taylor Mahavishnu Orchestra, we're going to the outer rim of the galaxy thing. And she moves with the fur, really does sound like something from Blackstar. So I was, I don't think anybody's expecting Paul Weller to make a kind of Tales from Topographic Oceans, ludicrous, out there beyond the fringe kind of thing. But by the standards of his past, I thought it was pretty diverse and pretty interesting. I'm with you on the faux Americana, because I don't think he does it very well. But when he wants to be Lewis Taylor, and when he kind of gets the toy box out, and when he starts to get a bit abstract, I was actually genuinely surprised and genuinely kind of taken by quite a lot of it.
I've listened to a lot of solo Weller for my sins, and kind of thought that Wildwood was really good. The first solo album before that, kind of quite liked it. It explored that kind of English psychedelia, kind of Traffic type of vibe. He lost it a bit, came back quite interesting. I really like this album, I've got to say. Yeah. Maybe comparing it to the ones that he's done past where I haven't enjoyed it so much. But I thought that this was... it's kind of like, felt like a guy who's actually kind of quite comfortable in his own skin.
I think it sounds like he's having quite a good time as well, actually. I mean, I thought there were some actually quite exciting bits in this record. It goes very insane towards the end. There's this amazing kind of Peter Skellen on part types crescendo in The Impossible Idea, which to me actually does sound like Blur, Circa Park Life, or even Theme for an Imaginary Film, the great Hidden Blur song. I was surprised to really enjoy this record, actually. I can't say I've got a lot of Weller in my record collection, but I thought it was pretty good. What are we giving it? Sort of qualified thumbs up, medium thumbs up?
There were great moments. I mean, One Tear is really good, which I think is the one that Boy George is on.
I liked One Tear, yeah.
It's a great, great pop song. I mean, I think that's the thing, is if he's going to keep trying to do different things all the time, if you're not on the train, moments of it will be really impressive and really charming. And other bits of it, you just be like, oh, no, you need to stop doing that.
Yeah.
Like I said, Woozy Mama was a real... You don't start from that and then go on to greatness. But there were great moments in it. So, yeah. Mid-thumbs.
Mid-thumbs, OK. All right, let's move on. We'll have a little bit more music in a different vein. Every week we ask our guests to bring in a track that they love at the minute, their editor's recommendation, as it were. Rebecca Nicholson of The Guardian and The Sunday Times, what have you brought for us?
I have brought Perfume Genius. Perfume Genius is a man called Mike Hadras, and he is from Tacoma in Washington, D.C. This is his fourth album, I think, and the album is called No Shape, I think, and that came out last week. And I realised when I was waiting for it to come out, I hadn't tried to pull any kind of music journalist privilege things and get the album in advance. I was waiting for it to come out, and then it came out on Friday, and I sat down and listened to it with a kind of excitement that I haven't had for such a long time, because his last record was one of my favourites. I think it came out in 2014. And I just think he's brilliant. He's gay. He's very kind of overtly queer about the music that he's making. Mm-hmm. It's outrageous at times. It's very dramatic. It's very kind of beautiful. Some of it's incredibly poignant. And I just think he's brilliant. He's a real one of a kind. Which sounds like a cliche, but I just think we're really lacking that kind of vision at the moment.
And I'm so sick of those one-of-a-kind people. they're all the same.
All the same. Yeah. I just think he's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. And he really is kind of ploughing his own furrow. Is that the saying? Ploughing his own field? Yeah. Furrow.
And
this is so dramatic and so bombastic, and I think it's brilliant.
Here we go then. Ploughing his own furrow in a field of his own. Here is Perfume Genius with Slip Away. Perfume Genius with Slip Away, as chosen by our guest Rebecca Nicholson. Okay, right, time for some dance music. The genesis of house music is explored in a new two-part documentary from Channel 4. And fitting in with the lifestyles of today's exciting young people, I was there when House Took Over the World has gone straight to On Demand on the All 4 app, so you can watch it when and where you like. Is this a story that needs to be told again, and does it need to be told by Sting's son, Jake Sumner, who directed this? We're going to find out after this track, one of the pivotal moments in the birth of house. Hands in the air, this is Marshall Jefferson with Move Your Body, the house music anthem. That was as much as we could fit in of Move Your Body, the house music anthem by Marshall Jefferson, as featured in the two-part Channel 4 documentary, I Was There When House Took Over the World. Because it's on demand, we can put the links on the Facebook page, you can watch it yourself. It's a pretty strange item, because it's not just because it's only available on demand, but because it's so short, two 20-minute episodes to tell the entire story of house music. We see the formative clubs like The Warehouse and The Loft, and we meet surviving DJs like Marshall Jefferson and Chippy. Rebecca Nicholson, does this work for you, firstly, as a documentary, as an odd format?
Well, I mean, it was informative, and it kind of worked, but obviously if it's 20 minutes, I think the first one was 23 minutes and the second one was 18 minutes, it's far too short, and it can only ever skim the surface. There was so much more that I wanted to know. But it reminded me a lot of Vice documentaries. It's kind of like big and flashy and very stylized, and you've got the text flashing up, and there's that kind of graininess to all the shots and everything. Yeah. But it is a documentary, I think, that's made for people with short attention spans. So it's like, here's all the essential stuff, and then we haven't got time for the rest.
Well, actually, that's quite a good idea, isn't it? Because the young people have no attention spans, and the old guys who care about it, their attention span has been shattered by raving, so it works for everybody.
Well, too many pills.
Absolutely, yes.
But this is, I used to work at Vice, so I have some idea of the young people. And it was a thing that always used to wind me up that people said young people don't have any attention span, because they do. They do have, you know, they'll watch an hour-long documentary about something completely unexpected. So I think it's ever so slightly patronising, not that you're being patronising, but to make a documentary for young people and say they can only handle 15 minutes.
But isn't it also to do with, and I was thinking about it because we worked at The Guardian together, and I used to make video documentaries and kind of pieces on music there. And it's also kind of budget limitation. You know, they had a budget to go to Chicago. They got some pretty good people to talk, but they only had kind of like stock footage of driving past the music box down that kind of down into that underground garage, you know,
and one photo of Frankie Knuckles that they precisely kept using again.
Well, and watching the two episodes back to back, that was really obvious.
Yeah,
I mean, I thought it was, and part of the budgetary thing was obviously as well. They showed they had shots of a record deck in a bare room, you know, on a bare surface, white surface, and somebody putting on the record, and they had a reel to reel of. Was it a Frankie Knuckles?
An actual Frankie Knuckles DJ set.
And then they had a cassette. And I thought that kind of worked quite nicely. You know, I didn't mind that.
To defend the documentary, I mean, I used to edit Mixmag, and I can tell you that there aren't very many pictures of these things. Yeah. And certainly very, very little video footage. And I actually think that's a feature, not a bug, because I like the idea that something is, you know, you just can't see it. It's in your mind. It's not over, it's not over recorded and over, you know, kind of frozen in time. And I loved seeing the kind of Ken Burns effect on that, you know, those old pictures of people at the warehouse. I particularly loved, there's two girls in the documentary who were like, they were regulars at the warehouse, and they must be in their 50s. I just thought
them was a DJ as well, wasn't
she? Yeah. And they're still really into it, and they were talking about what amazing time was. I just thought, I want to go in the TARDIS back. I want to go raving in the warehouse with you, because you look like you're the most brilliant fun going. Stevie, what did you make of it?
I loved it to death, but I thought it was far too short. I was fine with the visuals of the record player and stuff like that. I thought it worked really well. I could just have done with more of the people talking, because they interviewed like Nikki Ciano, Niles Rogers. I mean, it works at such a pelt. Like the entire history of disco, from, you know, Paradise Garage to Disco Duck to blowing all the records up at the stadium, is done in under 8 minutes, and it doesn't cover up the sort of racial politics, the sexual politics of disco. It's done really well in a breathless manner, but I did feel like I could sit and chat with those people, because there's an amazing bit where they're at the Chicago's legendary White Palace Grill. Eating amazing artery clogging breakfast and discussing 808s and 303s. I could happily have sat with that for an hour and just eavesdropped that sort of thing. Because, I mean, the thing is what we're learning is that there's like these people, they're mortal. They're really, especially if they're eating that stuff. Like, they're
very mortal, yeah.
Well, also, if they were kind of like heroin addict DJs doing kind of like 12 hour sets in the music box, you know, that's not a life enhancing.
But I want to hear their stories. And I think that was the thing. I think it was a great introduction. And I would like to see it expanded.
The reason you're not going to get that around Chicago House, and I was thinking, well, you know, this used to be the kind of thing that maybe BBC Four would do, like they did the kind of history of hip hop, or like they've done. But it's not, for a kind of number of reasons. One is that it's gay, and one is that it's in Chicago, so they weren't kind of in New York and being covered by. And it was over before anybody really kind of knew about it. And it's great hearing those stories, because you don't hear those stories about kind of that subculture. And you didn't really, I knew about the bathhouses and about how Larry Levan, but I didn't realise the connection between Larry Levan and Frankie Knuckles.
Yeah,
and Knuckles
going
to Chicago to set up on his own to kind of get out of Larry Levan's shadow. And I think that it's a real shame that you're not getting, you know, it's good that it's there, but it should be much bigger and much more.
I'm going to stand up for brevity on this one, because I don't think the reason that this is short is because the youth have no attention span.
Old man.
Yeah. I think if you mentally compare it to a BBC Four treatment on this, it would have been a good hour and probably three series. I think the issue is not people's attention span. I think it's just the fact that there's too much stuff around. And as somebody who knows this story quite well, I mean, I feel like I've written it myself three or four times. I learned new things here, and I didn't feel that it was rushed through. I think you know, you mentioned I think they did talk about the racial and sexual aspect.
No, they did. They covered it. I was impressed at how much they packed into those 8 minutes. But my head was spinning.
I was googling people that were coming up.
Yeah, I was too. Yeah,
and I was thinking, why? It'd be great to hear from that
Ron Hardy. What happened to Ron Hardy? They don't really
mention
what happens to Ron Hardy.
The tosser who did the Disco Sucks thing.
Yeah,
he's still alive, and
is he really?
He's like a syndicated DJ in the States. I'd love to hear him justify that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they were basically saying it was racist. It was like racist.
Yeah. And homophobic. Yeah. Mark Rogers writes about that in his autobiography quite extensively. It's really fascinating. Because I didn't know about that until I read that. So then seeing the footage of it in this documentary, it's just extraordinary.
Yeah.
But what I think it did really well, one of the things that makes it better than those documentaries that you see on a Friday evening on BBC Four, is what was missing in it, which is people like us sitting there saying what it was like.
True.
It was really great because it didn't have people go, or like modern people going, oh yeah, I really like this, and saying something non-insightful. Everything about it was great. Nothing. There was no flab on that documentary, and I'm not saying I want more flab. I want another serving of the meat.
I could have just spent like half an hour watching that old fella take the records out of the shelves in his garage.
Great, wasn't he?
Is there seriously? If there isn't a sample of somebody, you know, at the start of a house record shortly, we need to hear that old guy saying, what we need to hear now is some good old-fashioned house music. It's just like, for a drum to kick in. Do we think it's going to work for 25-year-olds for whom, you know, Disclosure is the beginning of house music? Are they going to go like, oh, yeah.
Well, I think it's going to work for anyone who's interested. As someone who is, house music is one of the few musics that I'm not relatively up on, I would say. I'm intrigued, but I've just never... I think partly because it's not on album music and I'm an old man who likes an album. But, like, I was writing down, okay, putting on my Discogs want list, I need to get a copy of that. A copy of that. And I think it really worked as a way in and as a way to go into the past of it. Well, I think it was really informative. But also, it wasn't just facts. It was really great stories, human stories. And it wasn't just like, the club is here and people are taking drugs and the room is shaking. You had people saying, I went to the club because it was the only place I could hear this music. And I think that's a fascinating thing. It's mind-blowing in a world where, like, we've got, like, 8 machines in this very room that could play us the entire history of pop music at the click of a finger.
Yeah.
The scarcity of it is really interesting. And I think if you're 25, that's like an entire different world. That must be interesting.
Well, also, it's interesting to think that, like, this is a history of something that happened 30 years ago.
Yeah.
That's as far away now as the genesis of house music was from the Eisenhower era. 30 years prior to that, you are literally looking at people coming home from the war kind of thing. Well, I was there when house music conquered the world. Hang on. I was there when house took over the world. Is available now on the All 4 app, and we'll stick the links up on our Facebook page as well so you can have a watch yourself. Let's have another choice of music from one of our guests. CV Chick, what have you brought in for us?
Can I just preface this by saying I was going to bring in Feral Oms, which you very rightly said no one should have to listen to on a Sunday morning, but you must go out and buy the Feral Oms record if you like the sound of the Apes from 2001 playing freak out psychedelic music. So I advert in there, but I took a very sharp right turn away from that to the tunes of Gabriel Garzon Montano, who is on Stones Throw record. This came out at the start of the year, but I just think it's criminally slept on, which is what the young people say. And I just think he's fantastic. He's a singer-songwriter from Brooklyn. He's kind of from the neo-soul side of things, but he's not hopelessly retro. He uses modern technology to make his music. But what I think is really interesting is there's this real powerful seam of melancholy through it, because at one point he's sounding like Stevie Wonder of Fulfilling This First Finale, which is the darkest Stevie Wonder record. But then he sort of taps into this thing that makes it reminds me of Till I Die by the Beach Boys, which is like the bleakest song that you can whistle. and for me, it's incredibly moving. And he's got a fantastic voice. He's a young lad from Brooklyn. This is his debut album. His mum was in Philip Glass's ensemble in the 70s. So there's probably a few interesting records that he grew up with.
Oh, stop going on and being so repetitive, mum.
Yeah, I think so.
All right, let's have a listen. This is Fruit Flies by Gabriel Garzon Montano. Okay, that's enough music. Time to move on to the movies. Alien Covenant is out this weekend, the latest installment of the Xenomorph series. Original director Ridley Scott returned to the world of chestbursters with the prequel Prometheus in 2012. He got a very mixed reaction for a movie which many felt missed the point of the whole Alien tale. Now Alien Covenant promises to tie up yet more loose ends. Do we really want them tying up? I'll be talking to our Alien Affairs correspondent Michael Moran after this. To get you in the mood, from 1979, it's Jerry Goldsmith's original theme from the first in the series, Alien. Okay, Mother, what's the story? Jerry Goldsmith's theme from the original movie Alien back in 1979. And here with me, I've got our space correspondent and Geek Desk contributing editor, Michael Moran, well-known man about the internet and digital editor of the Jewish Chronicle. Hello, Michael, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks very much for asking.
Are you got back to Earth yet?
I'm positively earthbound at this point, thanks. Yeah,
thanks to Alien Covenant. So we went to see Alien Covenant earlier this week, and we're going to attempt to discuss it without spoilers. Set it up for us. What's happening here?
This follows, not immediately on, but directly on from his other prequel to the Aliens sequence.
Sequence?
Is that what we're calling it now? The Thing, Alien Cycle,
yes.
Prometheus. But it's all a big coincidence. Don't worry about it. They're different people, largely, and it's just they turn up.
It's a colony ship, isn't it? Yeah, a colony ship is on its way and is waylaid by an incident.
Yes.
And finds itself on a planet bad things are about to occur.
Yeah, space is a lot smaller than you thought.
It is. It's about as big as a small British village, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because really? They keep running into these things. The gist is that obviously there are tropes in the Alien universe. The Alien cycle tends to involve people with torches going down dark corridors and getting chomped up. And this film doesn't disappoint at that level, does it?
It doesn't. I mean, it is quite grisly and people have things inside them that shouldn't necessarily be there and this kind of thing, and there's indigestion. But it does seem to be that whoever these space people are in the future, they're fabulously incurious and unscientific about the way they go about things. They just ignore massive things that are going on around them if it serves the plot for them to ignore them.
Yeah, so essentially what you've got is you've got the caretakers, actually, of the colony ship find themselves on a very leafy and verdant planet and wander out observing biohazard protocols that are not as strong as the ones my parents observed when they went to Spain in the 70s. They're sort of walking, breathing the air, fiddling with the plants, all the rest of it. And then, surprise, surprise, things start to explode out of people's bodies. My problem with this is, Prometheus didn't go down particularly well, did it? People felt that it was overly concerned with the space jockey, that guy that we see in the original Aliens, he's sort of welded to his seat with a big hole in his chest. And Prometheus expends 2 hours explaining who is the space jockey. And, for me, in the original Alien, the space jockey was just this amazing, mysterious thing that you shouldn't think too hard about. You should just let me part of the background. And the thing with Alien Covenant is, to me, it's not a prequel to Alien. It is the Prometheus sequel. And if you ask yourself, how excited are you at the idea of a Prometheus sequel? Not very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I must say, I feel very inadequate that a lot of people do like this film, whereas I thought it was a thorough stinker.
Yeah.
It unpacks far too many things from the Alien franchise and shows you them when they're better as mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain things. It's a bit like a blockbuster film is a bit like a sausage.
Right.
You enjoy it.
Yes.
You don't necessarily want to know what went into it.
It depends what kind of gourmet sausage we're talking about here.
Yeah, I know that you're a sausage man through and through.
I am a sausage man through and through. For me, Alien Covenant is very much a Walls Pink fudge job because it's the same reconstituted elements chopped up in a slightly different order. There's only two problems for me with Alien Covenant, the cast and the story. Everything else is absolutely fine. The setting and the production design is wonderful. Compared to the cast of Alien or Aliens, these caretakers are a very thin bunch, aren't they? I mean, When you look back at how immediately we understood exactly everybody on the Nostromo, Ash, Yaphet Kotto's character, Lambert, they were instantly, immediately well drawn and stayed in your mind forever. Could you tell this cast of Alien buffet members? Could you tell them apart?
Not really, no. Billy Crudup, yeah, fine, thanks very much. Remembered him. He had some kind of backstory that we were supposed to understand, but we didn't because we didn't care about it.
Yeah.
There was one other person who had a star of David Pendant. I was supposed to care about them.
Yes.
I didn't because I forgot who they were. 2 minutes later, I was thinking, now, which one was she? I can't remember, nor do I care. And they were all really annoying. All the people were really annoying. And I wanted them dead.
Yeah, I think
I was on the Alien side.
It was very much along the lines of Prometheus, where rather than in Alien and Aliens, where every character behaves as a human being would under these extremely strange circumstances, here people are just pushed along by the plot. They're like a bunch of cardboard cutouts wandering from incident to incident with no logical reason. I mean, we can hang in a slasher movie, everybody loves the moment where you say, don't go through that door. But 2 hours of screaming, don't go through that door.
In a slightly different tone.
Yeah.
It was more like, oh, don't go through that door,
not
you
again.
Absolute mug.
Mm.
What's wrong with you? And so, drawing back to the first two Alien movies, which I think were just brilliant.
Yeah, but they are perfect films, aren't they? Yeah.
The second one especially, there isn't a line in it that isn't quotable in some way. There isn't a line in it that you still doesn't creep its way into modern conversation. But, what, 3 days after seeing this film, I can't remember anything that was said. I can't remember any of the people. I can't really remember what happened. And I would not see that again on purpose.
We are threatened with a further two prequels to fill in the gap between this and the original Alien movie.
We don't need that gap filled in. It's a lovely gap.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're right. It's a lovely gap. And what made those films originally so amazing was it is in the gap where you fill in your own horrible imaginings exactly what's going on here. Mm. I don't want it all explained. It's like when they started to explain who Darth Vader was. Oh, he's not the eternal god of evil. He's somebody's dad coming back with a story. We don't need that, do we? Stop explaining things, Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly this. We want things left unsolved. Well, apart from crimes.
Okay, we're at the end of the show, and that means closing time chatter. This is the part of the show where our guests tell us the story, or the idea, or the feature, or the internet argument that's been getting their goat this week. Rebecca Nicholson, what have you got for us?
Well, I've been watching a TV show. It's on Amazon, so it's a streaming show called I Love Dick, which is based on a cult feminist novel that was thought by many to be unfilmable because it's kind of...
Let me guess why.
Because it's part memoir and it's heavily based on critical theory and it's very bizarre. And Jill Soloway, who made Transparent, has made this into a TV show. And I think it's quite brilliant. We were talking about pretentiousness at the beginning of the show and it is absolutely pretentious. But I think if you can accept that and go with it, then it's a really inventive and magical show. And I was thinking about other novels that have been thought of as unfilmable and when they've been filmed and if it works. And the only one that I could really think of that actually seemed to do something different with the story and yet stay true to it was American Psycho, which Mary Hannon made in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And I thought having a woman make that film, which is so kind of violently misogynistic and awful, was a really clever way of making it funny. And it brings out the humour in the novel in a really different way to kind of see it through a woman's eyes. So that's what I've been thinking about, unfilmable novels.
Unfilmable novels. Yeah. Well, there we go. I Love Dick on Amazon. Stevie Chick.
Yeah.
What have you got?
Okay, well, I'm the parent of a small child. Although I have seen the pilot of I Love Dick, a lot of the times my telly box is streaming colourful characters
animated things,
getting up to stuff. And the thing is a lot of these movies that are aimed at kids are also supposedly aimed at the parents. And it often falls into this pitfall where basically there are loads of references and jokes that only the parents could get. And the children are kind of looking confused at the screen and the parents are like, well, that's kind of funny, but if I was going to watch something funny, I'd watch something for adults. So I think a lot of these things suffer quite badly because they fall into this grey area. But I want to talk about something that does it really, really well. And that's a show that's on CBeebies called Hey Dougie. H-E-Y... D-U-G-G-E. It's the story of a dog who is like the leader of the scout pack and the various animals that live, that come to join his scout pack. Each episode is about 6 minutes long and it's just fantastic. The animation is wonderful. It's done in a kind of isometric 80s video game style. It's really, really sweet to the eye. But the jokes are just really, really funny. It's not patronising on any level. It's just quite charming. It's quite bold and brave. There's an episode where they do a puppet show for a Lion King. And instead of being animated, all of a sudden the show becomes a puppet show and all of the characters are played by homemade puppets with lolly sticks on it. There's one about tadpoles, which just makes me... die. It's the whole thing is about like how these tadpoles don't realize that they're going to turn into frogs and then they do before the kids' very eyes. And
this sounds like a better version of the Alien film, actually.
it's just hilarious. There's one bit in it where these tadpoles suddenly turn into adults, into frogs, and to show that they're making the jump from childhood to adolescence, one of them goes like, I'm going on a gap year, and then the other one goes, I'm going to get a job in the city, and it's which obviously my daughter doesn't necessarily understand why me and my partner are rolling around on the sofa laughing at it, But it does it really. It just does it really, really well. And like I sort of resist saying, because obviously I'm slightly infantilized from having become a father.
Yeah.
I'm a withered shadow of the man I used to be. But like I do genuinely think that I would watch this even if Marion wasn't asking to watch it all the time.
So that's Hey Dougie on CBeebies.
CBeebies.
And it's iPlayer. Only 6 minutes long.
Only 6 minutes long.
I think it's today's young people's short attention span.
it's today's old dad's attention span. I struggle with anything. That's why I like the House documentary. Yes. I was just like, okay, I can have a nap now.
Excellent. Matt, what have you got for your closing time chatter?
I do have got something with kids, but it's more to do. It's like how hip-hop. There was a rapper called MC Trick, who came from Trick Daddy, who came from Miami. One of his tracks had a chorus with the slightly sinister line, "Trick loves the kids." But but actually, it's come to pass that the hip hop does kind of love the kids. It's brilliant. There's a video on YouTube that features a young guy busking on a street corner in New Orleans. He's got an upturned bucket and he's drumming. And he's rattling out these drumming patterns, and then Questlove from the Roots comes up with his own bucket and sits down beside these kids, and because he was tipped off to him by Common, who saw the kid the previous day, and sits down and starts drumming with him as well. And then Common comes up and starts rapping, and it turns out that basically this kid didn't know about it. There's loads of cameras around. Questlove ends up kind of giving this guy a drum kit, and it's like it's a lovely human interest story.
So this
story.
Is basically, you're talking the hip-hop version of Jim Will Fix It.
It's
really.
Essentially like that.
Hip-hop
yeah.
will fix it yes, without yeah. all the nasty totally. Parts.
Yeah. It was a different era.
Is this available on the YouTube?
It's on the YouTube, we'll put it up, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Fantastic. Well, my closing time chatter is, well, there's nothing more boring than listening to what people did on their holidays, but I've just been on holiday to the San Francisco area, visiting family out there, very lovely, lovely and sunny. We went out for a drive out to Point Reyes, which is the kind of, you know, the green, beautiful, rolling hills bit out in the north of Marin County. You can go and you can see whales and all the rest of it. We went to get a sandwich in a shop in Inverness. A place, it actually looks like Inverness. It will be green. And I'm waiting in the queue for our sandwich, and there's an English voice behind me. And I think, oh, it must be a British bloke. I'll turn round. I'll tell you what, mate, you don't half look like Robert Plant out of Led Zeppelin. It was Robert Plant out of Led Zeppelin. I said, my God, and, you know, what are you doing? He said, I'm getting a sandwich. And we had a chat. And what we talked about was his beloved Wolverhampton Wanderers beating Liverpool in the FA Cup, a game that I was at. So I had a chat about football with Robert Plant out of Led Zeppelin in a sandwich shop in Inverness, California. And it was really nice and really friendly. And he bought a packet of digestive biscuits. So there you go. So that was the exciting thing. And my brother and sister-in-law were going, who's that English guy you're talking to? I said, it's Robert Plant. And the pair of them were like, ah, I'm excited. So to me, the surprise was, you know, in the job that you're in, you meet a lot of quite famous people. But when you're not mentally prepared for it, it's one thing walking into a room and, hello, Madonna, you're a bit shorter than I thought you'd be. Hello, Kylie Minogue, you're exactly as short as I thought you'd be. It's a bit different when you're in a shop and it's like, bloody hell, actual rock legend behind you with a packet of digestive biscuits. So I just wanted to pass that on. And that's the end of the show. So there we have it. Thanks to our guests, Stevie Chick, rock and roll writer from Mojo, The Guardian and Kerrang. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And Rebecca Nicholson, also of The Guardian and The Sunday Times too.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And thank you also to Michael Moran, who has already entered hypersleep and he's not in the room anymore. Don't forget, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again, and you can hear all of our past shows at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth. You can also subscribe at the iTunes Music Store. Just search for Big Mouth in the podcast bit, hit subscribe, and you'll get the podcast early, around about Saturday lunchtime, so you can blot out the misery of the final few days of the football season. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye bye.